David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 389. I'm your host, Steve Raker, here in the comic book bunker, restoring the dampeners on my failing interdimensional portal. The things that were coming through there? Here with me, doing his part to improve and maintain international relations, is Whirlwind X Kevin, back from his weekly briefing at Department H. How goes it, old chum?
Did Lumpy thing come through?
Is that a reference to keeping the maple syrup pure?
Some cross-podcast continuity there about all the maple syrup.
Marvel,
you need that strategic reserve of maple syrup.
It's true. There's some things that you just can't let run out. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. Our scope is all things Marvel, but, you know, we got a particular fondness for the Bronze Age. There's still a lot of stuff to share with you from that, Kevin.
Yeah, I'd imagine, yeah.
You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com and get new episode announcements, give us feedback, see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Don't forget to find other fine podcasts from our ex-SHIELD dispatcher, Derek Coward, and his Deliberate Noise Network, which includes Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk about indie comics that just recently hit 500 episodes, like over and over again, Kevin. Couldn't be contained to one episode.
You cannot contain indie.
Andrew the LA Rabbit will be along in a bit for a meaty recent reads roundtable. But while he's not here, let's talk about him. No. Actually, there's a book I wanted to cover that I know he hasn't read, so let's hit that while we wait for him to come out of his hole.
And... Whoa. We're a little late for that, aren't we?
Now, as
or does it work differently down there?
It's true. It could be a fault line rather than a hole or burrow. Now, when we cover events like this on the show and really current comics in general, it's not like our Marvel Tales deep dive into the stories of old classics or sleepers that we've dug up. Because our aim isn't to spoil events or substitute our coverage for reading the comics themselves, but kind of to present the structure of the event and its tie-ins, like what characters appear where, with what creative teams, is a tie-in relevant to the aspect of the event that you're interested in? We try to tell you so that you can decide what to buy and read, educated enough that, you know, you don't miss that appearance of the Shroud that you otherwise would have.
Wow, the Shroud.
And Kevin, there's like 3 or 4 events a year now, if not more. Who can afford to read them all and all the tie-ins and everything otherwise?
Remember when there was 80 events in a year because they said every title was an event?
I remember when it was one each summer, you know? But
if you... yeah, I guess that was one. But the events might have meant something different to me. Because if a book was going bi-weekly during the summer, like, to me, that was an event. Like, they didn't call that an event, but that's effectively an event.
It's true. That's when they really started putting the, like, title banners for arcs on the books, too. You know what I mean? So it gave the, you know, because this is pre-trade paperback collection publishing time, so but to like frame an arc that way really did make it seem like an event.
Yeah,
like that Sidekick's Revenge. We got to do that book soon, man. It's like all signs lead to that book these days, it seems, with the Moon Knight stuff, and too funny. Well, what we got here is the Devil's Reign event that was born of the currently ongoing Chip Zdarsky written Daredevil run,
which has been pretty good.
Yeah, it took me a while to warm up to it, but man, it really got cooking.
Yeah, I remember this famous first issue read.
Yeah, we weren't too impressed.
I know.
Now, The Devil's Reign, it's a 6-issue limited series event with 4 tie-in limited series and 3 additional one-shots. It's also a Marvel New York Superheroes versus the Police story where the heroes are outlawed, kind of like Civil War and Dark Reign. I don't think the title isn't a coincidence, right? It's also a political story of the Kingpin trying to hang on to and solidify his title of power as the mayor of New York City. It's an Fantastic Four story where Reed and Sue get incarcerated and Ben and Johnny have to rally the rebel forces. It's an Elektra story because with Daredevil and the Clink, she took over his role protecting Hell's Kitchen, and you know, where does she go from here? And Kevin, it's a Thunderbolts story. A new team up to old tricks.
Maybe. Did Abe and Melissa and
not the good Thunderbolts.
And they put the evidence on the table and said, here's what the Kingpin's been doing, and everyone
nope, it's like
thanks,
the Civil
Thunderbolts.
War. It's like the Civil War Thunderbolts, where it's like, that's not the Thunderbolts.
Oh.
It's also a Superior Octopus story.
Yeah, that's weird.
Bet you didn't see that coming.
No. I'm always surprised when he shows up and he's always... I wonder how long that's going to go. Like, I noticed when he showed up in Amazing Spider-Man, he was like teaming up with Aunt May and he's like, I'm superior and everything. And I'm like, he's still doing the superior thing.
It's also a Purple Man, Jessica, and Luke story. But most of all, it's a Daredevil Kingpin story. I mean, Kingpin is so mad that Daredevil messed with his head and he can't remember that Daredevil's Matt Murdock. He's like...
Matt has that swagger about him. He just steps over the line.
He does rub it in. But Kingpin's having like a midlife crisis between that, his old role as the Kingpin being contested for... the re-election. He even gets remarried. So long, Vanessa. Like, <it's> like if there's anything a sign of a guy in turmoil. He's the mayor of New York City, Kingpin, as the series kicks off. He's been haunted by Daredevil because he's got this secret file with Daredevil's identity in it, and he can't read it. He just looks at it, and it's blank, and he knows it used to have this information in it. He's so mad.
He's very mad.
So he lashes out at the heroes, like Civil War style, making it illegal for the heroes in New York City.
Or like the Powers Act.
Right. And then he also finds that the connection to his missing knowledge is related to the Purple Man and finds and misuses him to help achieve his ends as well.
Man, everyone's misusing him now.
Yeah. Remember when he was the top dog? Now, from Daredevil's side, he was in prison for what I thought was a really entertaining but also really intense 6-issue lockdown arc. In issues 31 to 36. And, you know, we've seen Daredevil in prison before, I know, but this was way better, Kevin, right? It was more comic booky.
Way better? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, did the Punisher show up in prison to get Daredevil out of prison?
And there's more going on in the prison than the surface dilemma, too. but Daredevil has his twin brother Mike Murdock taking over playing the role of Matt so that no one's making the connection. And Elektra is trying to improve the balance on her ledger by stepping into the role of Daredevil, protecting Hell's Kitchen. But by the time the arc's over, he has to flee the coop and help Elektra face a very different take on the problem that is Bullseye.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Edge of Bullseyeverse.
Totally. So Devil's Reign 1-6 is written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Marco Cecchetto, which is the regular team from the Daredevil book. Cecchetto's become a beast, Kevin. It's unbelievable. His art is really good.
All the way back to, what was it, Shadowland? I remember going,
yeah.
Oh man, this is so good.
I mean, so much is really from the page design to the panel composition, the anatomy, the flowing hair on the female characters that look like something Esteban Maroto really took his time to draw. I mean, it was really so good. So the heroes are outlawed like the Civil War and hunted like Dark Reign, but it's Devil's Reign, right? And, you know, in that arc, Norman Osborn had his Thunderbolts, the Dark Avengers. So Fisk recruits his own team of Lady Electro, the Rhino, that surviving female symbiote. I thought it was Shriek, but I guess it's Agony now.
Not Scream?
Right, Scream. That's what it was. Scream, you're right, not Shriek. Okay. Shriek was the other one. Yeah. You're right, Shriek, but no, it's Agony. It's still Agony.
And, they always have great names.
Whiplash and Taskmaster and U.S. Agent. And it's kind of a surprise.
I mean, he is a U.S. agent.
The hows and whys of him being on the team is covered in the Devil's Reign Villains for Hire book over three issues, written by Clay McLeod Chapman with art by Manuel Garcia, and then it folds back into the end of the Devil's Reign book. But there's a lot of this Dark Reign vibe of the heroes being chased after and the bad press and the guy in charge doing his thing and having his team out there making the arrests and stuff.
I just have to assume he's crazy, or the villain of the piece is crazy, because these things, like, they'll say, okay, this is what the rules are, and then it's like 2 seconds later it's like they're breaking the rules. I just have too many questions. Cause it's always the thing, like, oh well, it's people with superpowers, and then it's like, oh, but this guy's a martial artist, well, throw him in jail too. Or, oh, this guy has this, oh, this guy's a soldier, throw him in jail. And I'm like, or like that other thing where they said, oh, we're going after teenagers, and I'm like, why are they going after Spider-Gwen, Ghost Spider? Then I'm like, she's not a teenager anymore. It's just, it gets out of control very quickly.
Among the prominent arrests are the Fantastic Four's Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Woman, and Moon Knight, whose one-issue tie-in Devil's Reign Moon Knight number one is written by his own current series writer, Jed McKay, with art by Federico Sabatini, who's, I thought, was a little bit too manga with the Final Fantasy hair and everything. But it serves not only to tell the tale of Mark Spector in prison, being a badass, but it also takes him off the board for an issue of his own book so that Hunter's Moon character could step in and fill his void, which ratchets things up in his title for Moon Knight's return.
Yeah.
And it's actually not the Thunderbolts who apprehend Reed and Sue, because Fisk employs Doc Ock to do the job. After all, he's superior, right?
If he's superior, why would he allow himself? I guess that's a story.
And Fisk needs you know, he's not a scientist. It's not like when Norman Osborn, all of a sudden they made, oh, he's good with chemicals. Now he's good with, like, everything, including Iron Man armor. Now they've got Fisk. He's a gangster. He's a thug. So he needs scientific support so that he can force the lack of cooperation, I guess more exploit the Purple Man. And so he sets Doc Ock up in the Baxter building as his base of operations, so he's got access to all of Reed's stuff while, you know, Reed and Sue are in prison. And Ock has his own separate agenda, uses this portal to bring in a team of other Doc Ocks that pose as superior versions of other characters besides Spidey. It's really weird. But that's in The Devil's Reign Superior 4, issues 1 to 3, written by Zach Thompson with art by David Tinto, where it all gets flushed out. Fleshed out, I should say.
I was going to question that, but...
There's a lot of flesh. That whole character is grotesque. And then besides the superhero-y resistance, the good guys put up a candidate to oppose Fisk in the election, and it's not who you might think, but it's a great choice nonetheless.
Oh. Is it Daredevil, or are they finally doing that story?
Also, with Elektra still operating as Daredevil, the Kingpin, Fisk, sends Kraven the Hunter after her, giving us a 3-issue Daredevil Woman Without Fear book by Chip Zdarsky and Raphael De La Torre. And in that book, it also focuses on Elektra's connection to the Hand, including a confrontation with this, like, Madam Hand, who I never knew about before. But in the last issue, it shockingly leads into the new Punisher series. Really didn't
see that coming.
No, that was a complete surprise and intrigued me, actually. In the Devil's Reign Spider-Man one-shot, which is written by Anthony Piper with art by Zay Carlos, the Ben Reilly Spider-Man, who's in the current book at the time, was working for Beyond and was the acting Spider-Man. He gets arrested, but he manages to escape, and he has to deal with the menace of Fisk's masked son, the Rose. Remember him?
Oh, I love the Rose.
The one that really was weird in it, fact that it really only in a tertiary way tied into the series. I mean, you thought it was tied into the series, and then at the end it wasn't. It was just a personal thing, is the Devil's Reign Winter Soldier one-shot, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, with art by Nico Leon. Bucky Barnes infiltrates the Kingpin's honeymoon compound, you think to get the file that started all this, but it's not. He just goes to get hit. Well, I guess I'm going to spoil this. He goes to get his own file that the Kingpin had, just as a personal thing. So it really, there's a big confrontation with the Kingpin that's really cool, and a fight and everything, and the Winter Soldier's being all spy-y, but it was only loosely tied in. And then the last tie-in is a 3-issue Devil's Reign X-Men series by a really solid team of Jerry Dugan and Phil Noto.
Because I think this tied in, or at least to the, I didn't read it, but it seemed like it tied into those Marauders issues.
Well, it's because the X-Men have this New York City treehouse compound where they're pulling this Captain Krakoa farce off to try to hide the fact that they have discovered a way to come back from the dead. So they're superpowered, so they try to, you know, Fisk wants them out of there, and so the Thunderbolts go and confront them, but it ends up being Emma Frost versus Wilson Fisk on a more political level of confrontation. she gets one over big on him, allowing them to stay there by really going over his head, and then he digs up this retconned event from years ago involving the seeming murder of this girl and attributing it to her and putting her on trial, and the real history of what happened involves Elektra and the black suit Spider-Man even. And then she goes on the run, and then Union Jack tracks her down. Huh? And it's like a Union Jack versus Emma Frost thing. And then at the end, it's Emma getting one over big on the Kingpin. And it kind of just leaves with them having unfinished business, where she's like, if you get out of this thing, I'm an enemy of yours now, kind of thing.
Weird.
Yeah. There's also a whole Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, Purple Man, like, line running through the whole book, because, I mean, it's even got the Purple Man's kids in it, too, because they get hunted. It's Purple Mania for a while.
Purple Mania.
But, you know, I don't want to spoil the end of it or what goes on, but I found the conclusion really satisfying. I thought there was a big build-up to the big finale confrontation, and I was satisfied with the outcome.
I think I made the mistake of, like, listening to a review and of the first issue, and they were like, yeah, this is Civil War with a twist. Oh, it was so good. And then I read it, and I'm like, it seems like too much of a rehash riff of Civil War. But, I mean, it sort of morphs into some new stuff, but
I thought it was
still has those little things that bug me about some of those things.
I thought it was more like the Dark Reign status quo that followed Civil War, just that whole time with the bad guys kind of in charge, but more compacted into a story that kept moving along. And in the comparison to the Civil War, and I know Mark Miller is a fine writer and really a great interview, fun to hear talk about comics, loves his comics, knows his comics, but there was so many things about Civil War that bothered me characterization wise where I felt like he was sticking characters into roles that he needed them to play for the story or to support the tie-in, so to speak. And there's some of that goes on here, but everyone I thought acted really in character. I thought Zardsky did a really good job with the characterization of a really wide cast of the Marvel Universe. I mean, the scenes in prison of Reed and Sue, the Invisible Girl, and Mr. Fantastic are really fun. I thought there was a lot of good stuff here. I recommend to check it out when it comes out on the Marvel Unlimited, when it drops there. I thought it was good. And the art is ridiculous. I mean, Chichetto is so good. His choice of using dramatic splashes within the book, you know, like mid-issue splashes and stuff, I thought he really has leveled up for a while. But this was, I mean, they gave him an event book, obviously, so this was his big, big shot, so to speak. But big opportunity, but I thought he totally nailed it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, he's like, I would say superstar. Like one of those guys, you see on a book, I'm always happy.
So, you give it a sideways thumb, a thumb down, or a thumb up, Kevin? What do you think?
If I have to go with one of those, I guess it's a sideways?
Yeah. Really bothered you that much that you've seen this kind of story before?
I mean, that was part of the.
Is it that you're getting old enough now that you're having to relive all these things and see that, oh my gosh, it's all cyclical? They're just copying old beats over and over again.
Well, I just find it funny that every time they do one of these stories, I just keep on thinking of that power story where they had, oh, superheroes are outlawed, so the superheroes just go away. and the villains are just, and then it's like the police are left. Oh, we, and the police always said, oh, we can take care of this stuff. We don't need superheroes. And like massive amounts of police and everyone is getting killed. And they're just like, oh, well, there's no superheroes. Oh, well. Because they're like, oh, you just outlaw superpowers. And the villains just go, we don't care. Like, it's such a me thing that I would have thought about or wanted to see. So I can't get that out of my head now anytime that something, now that I've seen it. It's just so good. When I think about that funness. It's like I never, not that it's fun. Oh, yeah, lots of people got killed. But, like, I never see that level of fun. It's always more annoying rather than the fun whenever they redo that in some Marvel type of thing.
And they, you know, and they kept it comic booky, I thought, the tone, even though there was sometimes some grotesque stuff going on, especially with the Purple Man, but also using the Purple Man as an excuse, they could have the, I mean, you can't have an event without a whole bunch of heroes fighting a whole bunch of heroes, right? Like all that was able to happen, and with some of them being mind controlled and that kind of thing. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
I think it's half of it is like a personal frustration thing. Sort of like with Civil War when like villains are getting away and then they're like, but we have to chase She-Hulk. She's getting away in her car. And then I'm just there talking the whole time, but the villains are getting away. Like,
it's not fair.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm like. I'm like, what are you guys doing?
But at least they weren't. You know, it was all tongue-in-cheek as far as its connection to the Dark Reign stuff, because they weren't hiding it. They put it right in the title by calling it Devil's Reign, you know?
Yeah, I mean, some of those things are played better in here. And then, you know, certain stuff goes on, so, I mean, I think it probably, there's more positive notes than in Civil War, where, I mean, that's kind of, some characters were kind of disillusioned, and you're like, I can't believe they're doing this stuff.
I mean, just think about the handling of the Fantastic Four. Were they more in character here or there, you know?
Yeah,
Spider-Man, were they more in character here or there, you know?
Yeah.
Tony Stark, Thor, you name it. I mean, you can go right down the line. It's, anyway. All right, we just covered a lot of comics, Kevin. 27 of them, if you count the 6-issue lockdown arc that we referenced.
That's a lot.
All right, let's say we bring on Andrew and get him in on this recent reads episode.
Ooh, it's going to be a good one.
Oh, boy, hold on to your seats. This is going to be a good one.
All right, this is good. I've got Andrew the LA Rabbit with me. I've got WWX Kevin with me. It's been a while since we've just gathered around the recent reads roundtable and fired some off.
For a second there, I thought you were going to say the campfire.
Gather.
Like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Old Man Winter's knocking at the door.
Yeah, you and I are both dealing with a cold snap right now, so my mind was sort of going there. I could.
Hey, it's cold out here too, guys.
Put on pants, Andrew.
Never. I'll die first.
Hey, I wanted to tell you guys that the Thing limited series, the one by Walter Mosley with the Tom Riley art, we reviewed the first issue on a past recent reads back in November on episode 378. And we kind of didn't really know what to make of it after the first weird issue, because it was like the Thing used a dating service to get matched up with a blind date. And then the chick was like a model and some powered up obsessed fan abducted her when the issue ended. And issues 2 through 5 have been out since. The 6th issue and final issue hasn't hit yet. But I like to catch up before the last issue hits, so I'm all like ready for that finale, you know? When the penultimate issue comes out, that's when I like to go back and like read the whole series if I can. And the series kind of structured itself sort of like seemingly done in one type stories, but with this overriding arc that becomes more clear and more central as each issue progresses. I mean, yeah, he has to go rescue the girl, right? Because she got abducted and everything. And he meets this adolescent youth along the way. And then the three of them are the players who continue on through the rest of the series together. And there's something more to both the girl and the kid. And in some ways, it's like Ben is almost like sort of just the strong MacGuffin that is almost indestructible, that can kind of survive the ride of what these characters are leading him through, because he doesn't know what's going on, and you as a reader really doesn't know fully what's going on. But there is like the champion, which is a great callback to that Marvel 2-in-1 annual with the boxing, you know, the big fight with the champion. There's Terax, there's Doom, and you'll like this, Kevin, there's the breakfast cereal of champions, Black Widows.
What?
Delicious. So it's, I mean, I guess we'll find out what is, there was a big reveal at the end of the fifth issue that relates to the whole dating event from the first issue. It's strange, but it is silly enough, comic-y enough, with the art and the Jody Belair colors kind of really creates a mood that isn't necessarily a negative one. It is entertaining. There's some stuff that you have to kind of just go with and hope that it's going to make sense when it all ends, but it's definitely fun comics, and the sequentials are good. The storytelling's decent, even though there's the mystery behind it all. It's worth checking out when it's on the Unlimited. I swear.
I hear Brains are back on the menu.
Brains.
I always remember that. I guess it was the first Wizard that I ever read, where Venom goes off on Chewy on the outside, or Crunchy on the inside type of bit, or the reverse.
Whenever you mention the Unlimited, I just think of the old segment we used to have with the Unlimiteds. Unlimiteds!
That was good.
Yeah, I assume you're referring to Venom with the brains?
Yes, the Lethal Protector. Yeah, I didn't know that they were going to have those, like, I've noticed that they've been getting more playful with the having more words or something on the cover. Like, they have that really good one on the Avengers, is it 54? Where Deathlok's just yelling.
Right.
And I'm like, now that's how to use one. I know some classic people are like, oh, you should do every cover like this. And I'm like, well, I think it would lose the effect. But you definitely need to throw in some of those some of the time. It's fun.
Well, doing it with the Venom Lethal Protector is a good idea, because it's a call back to that era that makes you feel nostalgic, right along with the name of the title, right? Because that was Venom's first solo limited series back in the day, I think. And if I'm not mistaken, the cover had him talking to the reader, one of those, like, you know, buy this book or I'll rip up your X-Men or whatever, you know?
Not some prismatic foil nonsense.
Yeah, it might have been prismatic too, but it was definitely him saying something along the lines of, you know, being in the solo title or whatever.
Yeah, it's my first time in my own book. Buy it.
And I won't eat your brain. But, you know,
right.
Are you caught up with the, with, like, what makes this different than the Venom series that was, I think there's been 6 issues out, and is that an ongoing? Did that end? I'm behind since the King in Black stuff.
No, it's still going.
Okay.
And then they launched a Carnage book. I guess a companion book. Like, I really need to, once that arc ends, I'm being like you, right? I don't know, something about those books, I guess. I'm just like, Yeah, maybe I'll just wait for a bit. Maybe I was a little venomed out after King in Black. Maybe that's the real reason. But
Yeah,
I
I.
looked at the creators and everything. I'm like, no, I'll probably want to read this. I'll just, wait a little bit.
Yeah, because the King of Black stuff was pretty good, and at least the Venom side of it was really good, so I wasn't ready for a whole new status quo, another take yet. I was still kind of basking in enjoying the venomness of all of that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think I got a little. Maybe it wasn't the King in Black because the last issue wasn't the King in Black, right? Maybe the last issue made me venomed out. Because I think it was the epilogue thing, and then I mean it didn't really amount to a whole lot. I mean, that's fine. I mean,
Well, they got to dress the whole thing with the kid and everything, you know?
yeah, I mean, I was like, oh, this is where the final showdown with the Maker happens. And I'm like, not really.
So, what's the deal with the Lethal Protector, and why is it different than the regular Venom book?
Well, much like some other books that they've done, they harken back to another era. Except I think it's weird because sometimes some of these are like flashback tales or another tale, and sometimes it feels like they're totally in the present. Like I would put the Iron Fist one in the same category as this book, but that Iron Fist one was completely modern. Like I was surprised and impressed by that book that it went the direction it did. I think this is more comfortable for people if they're looking for some more like classic, I guess you would say McFarlane-ish Venom looking, because he doesn't have the giant, crazy Eric Larson tongue and green saliva dripping all over the place. So this is Michelinie, or Michelinie,
Oh, that's cool.
coming back to the character. I'm not familiar with the artist, Ivan Florelli, but he does a decent job with what's here. I mean, I think there is some, what do you call it? Not brain eating. I mean, it does make some references to brain. There is a character here, Humbug, and I was just like, wow, that's a pull. Because I remember that when you're digging through the bins, there was always that web of Spider-Man. It might have been the first appearance of Solo, where it's like the first appearance of Humbug, and it's like, Humbug, and then they make some joke, and then they're like, also, Solo's here.
He was in that Heroes for Hire title too, with the Black Cat and
Oh, that's right. That's weird.
the
Yeah,
Billy Tucci one.
yeah. But yeah, there's more surprises than that. But I mean, some of the other ones are pretty obscure, and I wouldn't say that memorable. But they could certainly. I think they're building on those characters, and that almost helps in a way. I mean, maybe they appeared in some '90s thing somewhere that I didn't read, or some Venom solo. Because Venom had all those things like Venom on Trial and Venom the Madness, like,
Venom in Hawaii.
yeah, exactly. Venom on vacation.
Venom goes coconuts.
Venom visits Japan. Venom's big in Japan. I don't know. Maybe they've already someone that's more versed in Venom history than me. They'd be like, no, that character is totally as has this storied history like Daredevil or something. But as far as I know, they're fairly obscure and don't have much of a personality, but it looks like this story is going to build them up as well. So I'll leave that surprise for people. But the Humbug thing is what really, funny enough, stood out to me too. And then you have your corporate intrigue in here as well. And then Venom doing a little bit of his Lethal Protector gig, where it's like, is he a hero? Is he a villain?
It'd be cool if Humbug could talk to the symbiote directly with his, you know what I mean? If just, and I know that the symbiote isn't a insect thing or whatever, but just because it's alien, you never know if like those connections could be there, you know? It just be it would be fun.
Well, it's funny, there is a moment in here that sort of hints at something that come in the future, they're like, oh, why don't you? And it's just like, no, it's not going to happen because this is the past, but.
All right. Lethal Protector.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Andrew, what have you been reading?
Well, as you guys know, took a bunch of the 90s off. So I always enjoy chances to catch up. And Steve, you may have mentioned this book, but IDW was doing the big spring sale. So it's 70% off. I had to pick up the Marvel art of the Brothers Hildebrandt.
Nice.
Which is a giant hardcover book. And it gives sort of the background. I did not know that they painted that original Star Wars poster, of which I have a reproduction of, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's my favorite Star Wars image of all time. And they grew to prominence for their Lord of the Rings. And then suddenly in the 90s, they pick up this job doing the Marvel card series, which, as you guys know, I don't know anything about till recently. Buddy sent me a bunch of cards, and I've already purchased a few graded cards to add to my
card. Oh, no.
But this book is really fun. I mean, 70% off, like, there is precious few art books I wouldn't get. In fact, I grabbed a bunch of other ones that are not even comic book related, a bunch of pulp ones and history and novels and stuff.
Oh, cool.
I really like them. What's neat about this one is they tuck in the middle the X-Men 2099 Oasis
book. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
By John Francis Moore.
Yeah, so I actually don't have that.
Man, as a guy who didn't read that X-Men 2099 title, it's a little rough sitting down reading that thing.
Yeah.
It seems very 90s, but what I particularly enjoy is there's a lot of the artist reference photos that they use. So, for instance, for the Thor one, the model has a hammer, like a regular hammer that you'd use to, you know.
Yep.
Because obviously who has a Mjolnir-style hammer in their house? So he's posing with like a regular hammer in his hand. And some of the fun facial expressions. But it's really cool to just check out all these. They're not done in a consistent style, which I'm less... Like, sometimes the image reproduced from the card is not that big. Like, they'll do two on a page. Like, some of them, like Hawkeye and Hulk, it's the full page and then little inserts of sketches and artist photos and things like that. And that's fine, you know, for them and the Invisible Woman, but I mean, some characters get the short shrift because they have to share a page. So, for instance, you know, Morg and Mondo, like very important characters in Marvel's history, they don't get a full page spread. I mean, how fair is that, Steve? I know Morg made your list of top 100 characters.
There were definitely some, you know, your point well taken, but I remember in flipping through the book that I thought that the design of the interiors left a lot of negative space at times because of how they, like, I liked it better when they did the fuller page with the little inset stuff because it just used more real estate of the page. But sometimes when they broke it down into much smaller images, they left too much gutter space that I would have preferred to just, I want to see more of that full color art, you know, even if it is Morg.
That's what I would prefer as well. And less of the, like, I'm fine with the model shots and the sketches being very small.
Cause the Hildebrands, they're, you know, traditionally trained painters. So they come into it with the whole, I mean, that's standard process is making your own sources to see where the light is going to hit and all that sort of business. So I thought that was fun to see some of that too. And you never know, you know, sometimes it's them doing the poses and stuff, which is always fun. Or in other books, you know, like an old Jim Starlin book, you'll see, and like the guys are all other guys from that time era that you'd recognize, like, oh, there's Wrightson is this guy and this person. And, you know, there's Wheezy on the cover of the first appearance of Swamp Thing and all that. So, you know, it's fun to see some of where that process stuff came from.
Oh, for sure. Because the other thing I like is when the model has to have someone help them pose to get a superhero, like a pose, or they'd be sitting on a chair back, and they're obviously going to take those elements out, but it's fun. And they do mention that, like, look, these are just kind of reference, and sometimes you'll see two photos of two different models and they'll merge them together and everything. So it was neat looking at that. And also sometimes you can tell by looking at it what they think, what I think was more referenced and what wasn't. But for me it's fun because it's like not only characters I don't know, like Random was a character name that Marvel was like, this is a genius name. We're going to sell the Random movie. But the other one I like are the outfits because it's frozen in time. So like Scarlet Witch is just that weird one piece bathing suit. And like Shadow Cat's like the green and yellow and everything. And not what I would, you know, because they're made to be contemporary for 93. So they're not going with classic looks. They're going with what was the look then.
Yeah.
Like Warlock was doing something different in 93
that's
or 4.
Part of the angle of the card industry, right? Like if we're going to have new masterpieces each year, it better be the updated version, right? But
yeah.
That's the whole series 1, series 2, all that aspect of card collecting. So, yeah, that was the fun thing. You'd see, I mean, just take a character like Quasar. Every set had a different Quasar costume because it kept changing.
But they also did some cover work that's included and promotional posters and like a Burger King tie-in and even some Star Wars later on, which comes under the Marvel umbrella again. Some team-up pieces. And it's like I said, if IDW is still running the sale, I hardly recommend it. I mean, you got to pay tax and shipping, but still, it's a pretty good bargain for that, for a big hardcover art book, which has a little bit more life to it, you know? Yeah. As some of us collectors have amassed large amounts of paper, sometimes, even if it's a fun trade or something, I think about, well, is this really something I want? And so the art books and everything are an easier buy for me.
Ditto.
Because I feel good keeping like that space that like I don't feel as bad eating up my limited bookshelf.
It's a great volume. I pre-ordered it. Definitely is on my shelf. I read the most recent couple of issues of the Kurt Busiek Marvels series that's been ongoing with the Alex Ross covers and the Yildiré Cenaire artwork.
From painting to painting, Steve.
Yeah. Uh-huh. This series, though, it's been like kind of chugging along at a snail's pace, I feel like it. But with issues 8 and 9, it really felt like it was seeming like it was tightening up a bit as issue 8 is continuing to focus on the origin and the first appearance of a new Warbird character. You guys remember back when Ms. Marvel was Warbird for a while when she was drinking?
Yeah.
And so this part of this series has Captain America and the Human Torch and Iron Man and the Black Cat and Arrow, the Japanese character that they introduced a couple of years ago there, and the Golden
Steve,
Age...
Steve, Arrow's the company across the street. I think they have a TV show.
And the Golden Age Vision. You know, that guy with the crazy-looking
design. Oh, I like
that guy.
Yeah.
And
very cool.
They're fighting alongside Warbird, and Warbird is actually a pretty interesting character. She's a Shi'ar human hybrid raised in Wakanda, where her mother was Shi'ar and her father was Wakandan, and her mother leaves and goes back to the Shi'ar Empire whenever their mission was done and leaves her there. And then her father leaves her to go off on some quest to become worthy of having the mom come back or something. She doesn't quite understand because she's still little, but he never comes back. So that's her mission, is to... You know, it's very Black Hammer, right? She's got to find her father. And
I believe, Steve, traditionally, he would have told her he's going out for a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But so this whole group, Captain America, the Human Torch, Black Cat, Iron Man, Arrow, the Golden Age Vision, and Warbird, and some dude who doesn't seem like he has powers, they get captured in an old castle citadel thing and escape, but coincidentally, the trail of Warbird's father leads to the basement of this citadel. Rather than escaping from it, they go down, and there's this giant slab of a door that's locked with hieroglyphics on it and stuff. And then the Black Cat steps up. There's not a lock I can't pick. If you could see my eyes rolling, they're rolling. But then it's like they open the door, and it's like, okay, issue 9. I got issue 9 already. This is great. But then issue 9 totally veers off the trail again, and issue 9 ends the same way issue 8 ends, with the heroes opening the locked door at the end. But now you have more context because you've seen it from the bad guys' point of view, I guess. But so something's kind of going
very
on.
Claremontian.
Yeah, it's. There's something going on here. There's a story that's interesting. This Warbird is interesting. I mean, it's Kurt Busiek, right? So there's going to be some... It's going to connect to something, call back somehow, and all connect, I guess. I hope. It's just chugging along at a snail's pace, guys.
I mean, I guess there's no fear of it, like, not finishing. They're just like, this is the story. This is what we're doing. This is what everyone signed up for.
Yeah, wasn't the Marvel's anniversary, like, 3 years ago, though?
They just have to stretch it out till the next anniversary, Steve. Next 10 years of...
Didn't they have several books? Like, they had, like, just Marvel? The Marvel? Or something?
Yeah, Marvel. And
then
Marvel,
didn't they remaster
Marvel?
Or release one with notes or... something with a prelude story.
One of them they made into the like a treasury edition, right? That was pretty cool.
Yeah, they've done a lot. So how do you feel about these black, white, and red series, Steve?
You know, the Distinguished Competition is doing them too.
Yeah, well, once one of them did it and it went over well, then they're like, hey, we can do more of these.
I liked the old Batman black and white thing back in the day, right? And then Marvel did theirs like Shadows and Light or something, and it was like 3 or 4 issues that were black and white stories that were cool. I like that. So I think it's clever to add the one color in. There's some characters it makes more sense to do it with than others. But honestly, it's an anthology, so it comes down to which creators are in which issues. Some of them are been really entertaining, and some of them have been like, just kind of generic.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a hot take to say that this is like your Marvel tryout or your Marvel Comics Presents or Marvel Fanfare, like something like that.
There are some big name creators that are involved. They've just been peppering them out throughout.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they're all not in one issue. So you're definitely seeing a lot of new. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of new creators across the board too, though, Kevin, you know?
Well, that's the thing. Like, even if the story isn't the greatest, I always want to at least look at the artwork.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's not really a failure. But that being said, I've only been picking issues here and there. Like, I think I got the whole Wolverine because that seemed pretty cool. That also seemed like pretty ideal. But sometimes it's like a character I'm less interested in, or it just seems like, okay, I know how they're gonna use the thing, and I'm like, I don't know if I really wanna, like when they went with the Carnage one, I'm like, I've already seen Wolverine kill a bunch of people, like,
yeah,
it's less interesting for me to see a serial killer kill people.
And before that, Deadpool, like they did that with the Deadpool too, of him, and I enjoyed the Deadpool series, but it seems like they're, like you said, kind of playing some of the same notes with just inserting different characters.
So the Elektra one, I mean, I'll probably double back for a couple issues. And the fourth issue hasn't come out, I don't think it's come out yet. But they hinted in the, I think it was the fourth issue, where it's something about like Ninja Turtles or something, like Kevin Eastman or something. And I was like, Okay, that's in you're intriguing me here with your crazy solicit copy. So yeah, I decided to get the third issue as well. And like much like I said, definitely some standout artwork here. It seemed to be in modern history. I mean, it was always that Daredevil run by Ann Nesenti was always like a little weird anyways.
Yeah.
But in modern times, I'm always lost to a degree with the writing, I feel like. And they always seem to do these like little stories in like some kind of Daredevil or Elektra or what have you. And then I'm always like, what's happening here? Is this supposed to fit somewhere? And it does, but I'm just like, anybody should have went back and checked where this story fits in exactly, because I'm like, oh, I know these stories, and then I'm like, maybe I don't. So I just sort of go with it and go, okay, I guess this is what this is. Yeah, that's fine.
That for me was, I know everyone, you know, obviously I was reading Born Again and some of the Frank Miller and all that stuff, but really it was the Ann Nesenti JRJR stuff that is more the Daredevil I remember. No one is putting that above the other stuff, but for some reason the timing or my weird head or whatever, that's when I think of Daredevil, that's those covers and Typhoid Mary and all that stuff is what I think of.
Fighting Ultron. That's weird. Ultron and Mephisto.
Daredevil
villains.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of exciting. And then Daredevil doesn't even have a costume for a while. He's just like wandering the country.
He can steal from Spider-Man.
Humans, Blackheart.
He can steal from Avengers. Yeah, Blackheart. Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah,
that's for me. Weirdly enough, that's Daredevil, which doesn't make any sense. I'm crazy.
And then you have like the As the Seta story. I mean, that's pretty exciting. That's pretty cool. So, I mean, I enjoy popping in a month early to my scheduled pre-ordered issue.
I'm looking forward to the Moon Knight one.
Yeah, I didn't pre-order that one either, but I mean, I'll probably, because I think Hickman's doing a thing there too. So,
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so I'm always like, I wonder how that's gonna. But I guess I was already reading the main book, so I'm just like, I think I'll just pick and choose with the Moon Knight. Unless I see like some crazy list of creators I'll be like, ooh, I need that one as well. I mean, they're also like a little more expensive too.
Yeah,
but you get three stories, so.
Well, there's the real reason they keep making all these.
I know, right? Like, they're like, oh, yeah.
Less color?
I noticed that with some of the books. I'm like, is that really the price for this? And then I look, I go check the solicits, and I'm like, yeah, it was an oversized first issue.
Cheaper
but
to print?
There's one I have here, and I'm like, that was what was solicited.
Less color, and we can charge more. This is great.
I know. It kind of reminds me of, didn't they do some like black and white with the Zippo tone ones from like, I don't know, like maybe 05 or something? I remember picking up some of those. It was like the Indomitable,
right,
Iron Man, yeah, and like Howard Chaykin.
I was gonna say, I remember the Iron Man one. Sure,
yeah. So I mean, I'm always game for some kooky stuff like that.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, the madness. What I like now is when I see the True Believer reissues. People are selling them at a premium now.
No way.
I think this is the other funny thing. I think they've stopped doing that, but they've ramped up the facsimiles now. So
yeah, they can charge more for those.
That's just going to continue saying, hey, this is really Wolverine's first appearance.
Yeah. It's just funny. I mean, it's not as expensive as, but you think like this is a modern reprint. Like, why do you want $30 for it or whatever?
Yeah.
I like the old Marvel Milestone editions that they did in the 90s. And did they do it as far as the early 2000s? I can't remember, but it would be like a silver cover.
Well, I think they did. They brought it back. It was weird because they had those. And then I remember getting a few because I'm like, well, I'm not going to. There was no collections, basically. And I'm like, I'm not going to be able to afford those issues.
Yep. I got a few of them,
although,
too.
If you had the money, it would be way cheaper to buy those issues then.
Yeah. I always wondered. I guess the logistics would never make it happen, but it would be funny if they did some of those on the cheaper newsprint style. Like, really just make them kind of disposable,
yeah,
quick jobs that would lower the price point even more.
Digest.
You know, they're not paying anybody that much for that. They're not paying any of the creatives for that stuff, as near as I could tell. So it's all free money. But I think having a whole separate printing setup probably would not be efficient for them.
Yeah.
Right.
And I know they came out with some reprints again. And when they did that, I was just like, why do I need this type of thing? Like, I was in that sort of phase. I don't know. Maybe it was around 2000 or something. And then now that we came back to them yet again, and it's like now I'm past that point where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm digging these again. So it's so weird that I came around to some ideas again.
Love those Epic collections.
Yeah.
They are nice. They seem to select really... I like when they put like the original art and everything.
Yeah, the back matter is
good.
Yep.
But sometimes the back matter doesn't grab me as much, but you give me some alternative covers or original art or things like that, I'm on board.
A little article that related to the title from Marvel Age, they do that sometimes.
Yeah.
It's less of a selling point. But I got to be the contrarian on here.
Uh-oh.
That's your role.
Yeah, we all got jobs. I'm part of a... You know, in this internet thing, you end up in these groups with people from all over the world. So I'm chatting with these British folk. This is a young fella. So he's a Star Wars guy, but like a young fella Star Wars guy. And we're chit-chatting comics, you know, and other media. And he was mentioned that I was saying I like that War of the Bounty Hunters. He's like, oh, I haven't gotten to that, but the other ones are good. So he told me I should go check out Star Wars The High Republic.
I hear that's good.
Well, I'm pretty sober nowadays, kid. And he said, no, it's not that kind of High Republic, old man. So I jumped on the Unlimited, where they got the first dozen on there. And, you know, they're going to have other stuff. I don't know Kevan Scott, the writer. I do know Phil Noto, the cover artist. Kevin, before you give me some wiseacre remark about me not knowing nothing. I also did not know Ario Anindito, who is the first artist. It alternates. And it's not a knock against George.
Yeah.
Jorge Yenti.
The old Buffy artist.
I think for me, because these are almost all new characters to me, again, I'm an old man, so I read weird old Star Wars, but like, there are Star Wars people that have read all kinds of Star Wars stuff. Like, I fell off, you know, like after, you know, the first movies. Yeah, I read some of them novelizations and the newspaper strips or whatever, but not like, you know, those hardcore people. So maybe these characters already exist. Maybe Kevan Scott like wrote the Bible or what, I don't know.
But for me,
because the characters are new, the first artist gets an unfair advantage. I mean, there is like a one or two panel fan shot of Yoda, but that's just to like get you excited. You know, they got to put a little fan service in the book. But one thing that's very helpful is they put a little timeline. So this is like before the prequels. This is like, hey, you know, things are going well for the Jedi. And it centers on a young Jedi who's going to go from Padawan to Jedi, her Jedi master, and the opening of an attempt to do outreach to the outer rim. And so it's kind of nice because you're not in the main business of it, you know what I mean? And the outer rim seems particularly ripe for storytelling.
Sure.
For those of you that watch televised events, The Mandalorian references it extremely, even though a lot of it's on Tatooine, and that's where the baby Yoda comes from, which I like a lot. And then, you know, recently they've been having the continuation of Boba Fett had his TV show, and they're going to do Ben Kenobi and all that. So I never thought of Tatooine as the Outer Rim, but they talk about it. Like, it's the real Styx. You're out in the Tulies there. So they have to solve this mystery, and the Jedi's former master is having his own problems with the Force. He's a Trandoshan. Those are the Bossk, like, for those of you that remember The Empire Strikes Back. He's the big lizard guy.
The big long forearms.
Yeah. That's Like a Bossk, I believe, is the song that the kids like now. And so he's one of those, and he is suffering from a condition that's impairing his use of the Force. They're trying to solve a mystery on this outer world that involves a Hutt crime family and uneasy alliances with the Hutt crime family to stop a menace that could take over the entire universe. I mean, maybe not the universe, but at least the outer realm. So that generates the uneasy alliances and how to defeat this menace who is very space crazy. And I like in space when they have really space crazy stuff and large concepts and hive minds and all that fun stuff, you know, not just light swords and blasters, but more of your fanciful elements of science fiction. Because as been remarked, like, a lot of Star Wars was more a Western set in outer space with, like, you know, the smuggler and the kid from the sticks and the wise old man and all that stuff. So getting into your more ultra science fiction notions is pleasurable to me. Either are you guys reading this High Republic?
I bought a few random issues, like, you know, I do.
Andrew, you're gonna just flip for the first parents. I got it. I did.
I mean, some of them, like, you like the ask me about sometimes, is it's like buying a lottery ticket in a way. Like, some people like playing the lottery by buying a piece of paper and getting nothing in return, where I would much rather just buy a comic
and never read it and get nothing in return.
Exactly. Like, I'm like, I have that comic, I have something for it. So I know some people have debated which one is the better High Republic, because that's like a whole theme they have. I guess they'll get to it in a movie, an animated show, whatever in the future. I assume they have long-term plans.
So, I don't know if these characters
have the IDW series too. That's supposed to be, I guess, the younger readers, maybe slightly younger. But I know there's been some debate which series was actually the better High Republic comic series.
My understanding of all those IDW licenses that I've seen from other companies were always the Marvel Adventures version, whether it was Star Wars or the superheroes or whatever. But this, the first 12 issues is on. Like I said, if you like Jedis and solving mysteries and uneasy alliances, I thought it was fun. I mean, the only thing, I really don't like the lead characters. I feel like that, like, half-shaved head thing hit a peak like 10 years ago where every third, that's your shortcut for science fiction, is the half-shaved head. It's an undercut or whatever. I don't know hairstyles, but I feel like that could have was just poor timing in the face of an onslaught of, I don't think anyone's copying anyone. I think sometimes with pop culture, there just is almost a convergence of weird tropes that happen at various times, but that's a very trivial remark.
And so you're saying, like, ultimate Peter Parker's haircut, it's a thing of a time.
Well, like the 90s with all the mullets, and it's like crazy mullet. And not that I have a problem with a mullet or two, but when every other, it's either long hair or mullets. That's all that the 90s would give us. Yeah. For people who are listening to the New Warriors segments we're doing, you'll get a taste of that. If you're wondering, hey, where are the mullets in my comics? That will direct you right there.
And you can
tell Thunderbolts is ramping a little bit out of that, because Fixer Techno has the different kind of haircut going on there.
Just like we're looking back at old fashions when we look at the New Warriors issues, and looking back at a different age, so too are we looking back with old fashions and styles when we're looking back at the High Republic, because isn't that way in the past, Andrew?
Yes, before the prequels.
Before the prequels, and the after the prequels is already a galaxy far, far away a long time ago, so the High, you know, the fashions can be outdated if you're looking in the past.
So within the first year, they overcome that alien menace, but a vile group of bad guys use that as cover to attack various Jedi installations. So our heroes go undercover to resolve it. And that's where issue 12 leaves off. Not trying to give, obviously leaving out all the big spoilers, but it's fun. You can because it's Marvel, they have to have 900 spinoff series.
Yeah.
And I feel a little embarrassed that I've forgotten this had happened, but I did start Star Wars The High Republic Trail of Shadows because Wachter's the artist. How dumb, Andy, you need to get on this. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
I haven't ran into him in a show, but years ago, listeners of Sister Show Indie know we backed the Kickstarter. Way yes. back when, before he was a big-time guy that now can afford to have his staff push me out of the way. It shows. Just kidding, of course. And it's Daniel Older is the writer. And there it's more of a straight-up mystery. Like the Jedi's got to crack the case, you know. They're leaning into somewhat... I get a bit of a noir feel, but that might be the excellent Wachter artwork. I'll read anything by him. I'm just embarrassed it fell through my radar, but like I said, I feel Marvel, and this is where you guys can yell at me, they really beat things to death sometimes with spin-offs and extra titles and everything, and I'm like,
yep,
maybe just one or two titles, guys, but I don't want to cost anyone a job or anything, you know? It just seems like there is a lot of content, and it's not always clear.
It's hard to know when you're dealing with a licensed property what the terms of the agreement are. There might be a certain amount of revenue that has to be generated each month. There might be a certain number of issues that have to be generated each month or each year. It's hard to know what the quotas are.
But I feel like Star Wars is an established property. How about that? More in comics than in like movies or something, funny enough. And they've had like tons of series through Dark Horse and everything, so I always feel like you can have a lot of titles, have a lot of places to go.
Yeah, but I feel that a perfect example, that Dark Horse stuff. I mean, I'll read random issues here and there, but it's a complete mystery to me. There's like hundreds of random comics with different titles and everything. And like I said, I'll read it, but there isn't a way for me to be like, oh, I'm going to really get into this, because I feel like it's just a mess of different time and ages. And there's nothing wrong with just grabbing an issue and reading it, but it's going to limit my engagement as a result.
Well, maybe you should get a whole publishing order together and then like read through all of those as they were published.
Well, I think for me, it's just a problem. It's the same reason why I'm having, I think, so much trouble with 90s Mutants. Like, I feel like that was just a mess of different titles.
It doesn't get better.
Super heavy crossovers and confusing.
I did not read a lot of the Dark Horse Star Wars things here or there if there was a creator that really caught my eye. But what I did read was the Star Wars Legacy series that was set in the future, like, I don't know if it was like 100 years or 200 years or whatever, after the movies. So there are nostalgic callbacks to things, like as if you're reading Valentino's Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, and it's like, oh, they're searching for Cap's shield. It's like they're searching for, you know, the switchboard from the Millennium Falcon or something, you know, whatever it might be. And it was a guy who didn't want to accept the fact that he had any Jedi lineage. And he was kind of a pirate-y, kind of a bad guy. And he had a really good supporting cast. And it was just like, almost like the Joss Whedon Firefly thing where you're dealing with a small cast of characters that get very well developed that are on a ship trying to survive and stay under the radar of the bad guy, but then they realize that they're also the key to probably taking this whole thing down, and whether you have to, you know, when does the lead character come around and accept that that's his destiny and answer the call, and then deal with trying to succeed in the mission of taking the Vader equivalent down, who's this Lord Carrot, who is really evil looking and well designed and pretty cool. I really like that series a lot as far as any of the Star Wars greater universe that I read in the comics. The Star Wars Legacy series, really, really good, really well drawn, really well written. I think you'd like it, Andrew.
I feel like the Star Wars people really bring out great design work in general.
Yeah,
like the initial template is so good, it's like inspiring to artists, because even if like I'm not jiving the words out of the character's mouth, it's rare that I'm gonna be like, you know what, that's not a cool looking spaceship or alien or robot or, you know, blaster or whatever. I just feel like it's a wonderful aesthetic for me as a fan of that kind of stuff. But yeah, someday I'll figure out Star Wars and 90s mutants. Maybe together.
Well, I bet you'll figure out Star Wars first.
All right, to wrap up, I have a series that I wasn't expecting. I wasn't even expecting to pick it up, but I grabbed the first issue, flipped through the art, and flipped through the book, and the art was kind of pleasing to my eye. Leonard Kirk. So, not surprised. I hadn't recognized the writer's name. I didn't recognize the writer's name, Victor Lavallee, but the Ryan Stegman cover was pretty eye-catching. So I picked up the first issue of the new Sabretooth limited series.
And oh, yeah.
The first issue was intriguing enough that I picked up the second issue, too. I'm not a big Sabretooth fan, guys. I liked him as a villain character now and again. I think he got overused, overexamined, overplayed.
I think he was one of those guys that I really liked, like, when they first came out. Yeah, I was there when Sabretooth first came out.
I agree with you. Well, I think he was a perfect Iron Fist villain, but after that it was all downhill from
there. No. I was going to, like Carnage, I think I took a shining to Sabretooth in reading that whole Hammer Wolverine run and everything like that. You're like, Sabretooth is awesome. And then at some point after that, whether it was, maybe it was just a writer, I don't know.
You know what
it was good.
You don't really, you can't really come back to the character the same way usually again. And then you're like, you wonder if you were just because you were a younger reader or whatever, or it's no longer exciting anymore for whatever reason.
I never usually like the villain that's just the evil opposite of the hero. I guess that's why I think like Doctor Doom and all those great original Spidey guys, I feel like we're more, it wasn't then, I mean, obviously then you get to Venom and all those people who are just evil version of Spider-Man. And I don't know, I like it when there's the opposing elements, but I think we've hijacked Steve's Sabretooth segment.
No, I agree that, I mean, for me, I think it was maybe the Age of Apocalypse and putting it out there that like Sabretooth could be like good and noble and having writers occasionally reflect that. There's something to be said for, even though he was just another feral character at one time when Marvel had a gajillion of feral mutants in the 90s, but he was really bad, like irredeemably bad. Like when he's chasing Betsy around the X-Mansion, I mean, that was thrilling, scary stuff. And you knew that he was wanted nothing but the worst, you know? He follows Wolverine around and kills every girlfriend he has, that kind of stuff. I mean, he's a really bad dude. And then they made him good, even in our reality. And I don't know. But so he's bad again. And he ended up being, in the Hickman run, exiled into...
Yeah, I like that, though. Yeah.
Yeah, he was, like, on trial, and he got exiled into Krakoa's, like, Sarlacc pit, right? Into his gut or butt, however you want to think of where the inner exile point of Krakoa is, where he's going to just be there numb for all eternity. So then you get to this book, and in it, he's living out a Matrix-like reality, you know, where he is loving life. He's killing the X-Men every day and, like, killing them all and killing everybody and then kind of forgetting that he did that and reliving it and just satiated.
Back to Pleasant Hill, right? Wasn't that the Avengers one?
So he kills the X-Men and all his enemies after making a deal with Krakoa to retain his memories, which isn't clear why Krakoa made that deal with him, but instead of making him mind wipe every day and relive his penance over and over again, which is really his victory, right? Because he gets to kill the X-Men. This time he remembers, so he doesn't just stop at the X-Men. He wakes up the next day and he kills more and he kills all his enemies, and then he's like, now what do I do? And he sort of sets himself up like a King Conan like barbarian king on a brutal throne. He's a horror of a king. And then one day the sky opens and five more mutants drop in, and Krakoa and the council had said they would never banish another mutant like this to death. But yet, here are five more. And Sabretooth is the lord of this realm, as if he's almost demonic. He's got horns, his eyes are red. He's like a Belasco, controlling Limbo. And now he's got souls to torture, if you will. And that's how the first issue ends. The second issue focuses more on the five exiled mutants and how they got into this situation and what led them to be exiled there, rather than really focusing on Sabretooth. But I think this is going to be like a prison escape caper when all is said and done. But it's definitely intriguing. Not at all what I was expecting.
Sabretooth kills the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about the X-Men cartoon. That probably had some influence, too.